Thank you. Can you hear me with this contraption? Yes.
Yeah, I suppose you all have seen this. probably too late anyway.
Yeah. So first I wanted to thank the organizers for having me at this conference. I don't know whether I'm realistic enough to be here, but it's certainly always good to be back in paradise. So I will tell you about some open questions and about some solutions to deal with the Bechgard salt. Since I'm the first one to talk about organic conductors, I will try to also make a little review about the properties of these systems. For those who have been here, there have been already a couple of talks by Denis Jérôme and by Leo De Giorgi dealing with these systems, but I think it's worth reminding what are the main issues and problems in these compounds. The work, in addition to the review, the work I will present in which I've been involved, I've been done in collaboration with many people, and the optical data and optical data analysis has been done in collaboration with the groups of George Gruner and Leo De Giorgi. And the theory on which I will tell you a little bit more on how to deal with this confinement issue has been done in collaboration with Antoine Georges, Nancy Sandler, Silke Biermann, and Sasha Lichtenstein. Some of them are present in the audience. So what is the physics, or what is the idea behind these systems? Well, these systems were part of the effort of finding the holy grail of organic superconductivity, and these were the first compounds, they were synthesized by Klaus Bechgard, in which the organic superconductivity was discovered. And what is nice about these compounds is that, as we will see, they have a very weird structure, which is a quasi one-dimensional structure, so they are very far from the plain vanilla three-dimensional systems that we've heard, I would say, so far in this conference, and they have, by that way, very specific properties. Now, their building block are special molecules that I will show you in a moment. So we will come back on the building block, and these compounds have extraordinary properties. Some of them I will mention here, and some of them I will not even talk to, but they show practically every interesting physical problem known to the solid-state physicist, ranging from superconductivity to quantized Hall effect to phase transition of various kinds. And this is really a fascinating material, in some respect maybe too complicated, and I can only direct you to the talk by Denis Jérôme, whose transparencies are on the server at the ITP, if you want to know more on this material. Okay, so what are these stuff made about? Well, they are like plates that are stacked together, and the basic building block is a molecule which is this tetramethyl tetraselenia fulvalen molecule, nicknamed TMTSF or TMTTF. Yeah, I trained a lot to be able to say that. This is the realistic part of the talk. And this molecule has p orbital that points perpendicular to the molecule, the plane of the molecule, and as a result, when you stack this molecule as a cards in a deck of cards, or a plate in a pile of plate, what you get is you get I think I'll also reverse to the solid state physics stick, and when you stack this molecule, what happens is that the overlap of p orbital is maximum in one direction, and therefore the motion of electrons occur mainly along this direction, and therefore you get one-dimensional chains that are relatively well separated from one another, and in some direction are even more separated because they are counter ions. These guys are like kitchen salt, if you want, and the counter ions are there to provide the neutrality and to provide the charge transfer from the counter ion here towards the stacking molecules, and here X is the counter ion, which can be a variety of things, and the TMTSF or TMTTF, depending on whether you have selenium or sulfur on the basic molecule. We will see what it changes for the physical properties in a moment. All these are providing this quasi one-dimensional system. So it's a very nice system because it's a three-dimensional system. It's a real crystal. You can get very nice crystals. But on the other hand, the physics of the electron, of the electronic properties in this system, will be dominated by one-dimensional motion of the electron. So it's a way to realize a one-dimensional electron gas without having to realize a one-dimensional system like in a nanotube or a quantum wire. And of course, these systems will exhibit specific properties linked with the presence of these chains and the fact that electrons can still hop from one chain to the other. If you look at the chemistry of this compound, and I will not enter too much into the chemistry of the compound, you will notice that you have one counter ion per two molecules here. And essentially, if the charge transfer is total, it means that the band of the one-dimensional chains here will be quarter-filled. And we will come back to that, because the fact that this band is quarter-filled has some pretty deep physical consequence. So this is what I just mentioned. We have a quarter-filled band, and we could stay at that, but in fact, these compounds have an additional complication that I have to mention, is the fact that the molecules are not regularly spaced, and there is a small, here it's greatly exaggerated, dimerization of the chains, which makes the transfer integral between this molecule and the next molecule slightly different from the one between this molecule and this molecule. And as a result, if you look at the band structure of this compound, this slight dimerization opened by, I would say, standard one electron physics, it opens a gap in the one electron dispersion relation, which is delta G here, which is a very small gap compared to the bandwidth of this material. I will come back to what is the bandwidth of this material in a moment, but this dimerization is a very small gap, but still, the fact that this gap exists makes the quarter-filled band, or here three-quarter-filled band, in fact it's whole field, becoming a half-filled band. So now you start having something which rings in your mind, which is that you will get systems which are half-filled, and you have interactions, so it starts smelling of Mott insulators, and we will have to worry about the Mott insulator physics. And the question one can ask in this material, which is one of the questions that I want to address in this talk, is this dimerization between the molecules in the chain really important to get this Mott insulating physics, on which I will come back. So what are the physical properties of this material? Let me show you a transport property, just to start slowly. Here is the resistivity of various compounds in the family, where you can change the counter ion here, PF6, bromine, PF6, ClO4, and you change the basal molecule, TMTTF here, TMTTF here, TMTSF here, TMTSF here, and you see that indeed these compounds, at least some of them, have an insulating behavior. So we are happy here because we would say these are half-filled compounds, they have interaction, they behave as Mott insulator, and as you change the composition, the chemistry of the system, you go from this insulating behavior to something which looks more and more metallic, up to the point where you get something which looks like a nice metallic behavior up to 10 Kelvin or so, at which the system obviously undergoes a phase transition to something which is some ordered phase, on which I will come back. But if I focus on the high temperature properties, I go from something which is an insulator to something which is metallic as I change the chemistry of the compound, or as we will soon see if I apply pressure on the system. Now, what is the behavior of this system here? If you look at the temperature dependence of the conductivity, of the resistivity, it looks pretty much like a T-square law. So you would say that although these systems are strongly correlated systems, these guys here look like normal Fermi liquid with a T-square resistivity. And one of the questions I want to address is that is this true? And are these compounds really describable by a nice Fermi liquid? It doesn't smell right, because these are supposed to be one-dimensional systems, and interactions are there. So it would be very strange that if they could be described by a Fermi liquid, but the fact is there. You have a T-square resistivity behavior. This is another data temperature dependence, which shows very clearly this T-square behavior of the resistivity. One has to be slightly careful, because these compounds are stacks of molecules, and they behave like accordions. So if you hit them, the system expands. And when you want to do a realistic calculation, you compute things with a constant lattice spacing. But when someone wants to do a realistic experiment, he measures things at constant pressure. And if there is a lot of thermal expansion, you have to correct for this in order to match with what is the standard calculation. And this is the correction that has been made on this data by Denis Jérôme, where you see that essentially, if now you work, instead of working at constant pressure, which is the way this data is taken, you work at constant volume, the resistivity is not T-square all the way to ambient temperature, but it's something which sort of goes as T-square to start with, and then sort of flattens out at much higher temperature, which is the first indication that something strange might happen at this temperature. It's only an indication at that stage, but I want to point out that one has to be very worried about this volume correction. Okay, so let me move on to the phase diagram of these guys. So here is a sort of unified phase diagram. I told you that you can change either the chemistry of the compound, or you can apply pressure. And what has been shown over the year in various experiments is essentially that changing the chemistry is really like applying pressure. So it's like some kind of internal pressure, if you wish. So what one can do is take one of the compound of the family and then put it under pressure. And along this axis, you could put at various pressures the other compounds of the family. And the other compounds of the family would correspond to this compound under very large pressure and give you the same physical property. So it's a kind of universal phase diagram where essentially you can view this as a chemistry axis or as a pressure axis applied on TMTTF type compound. Now you see a host of various phases. If I am looking at TMTTF compounds, as you saw on the conductivity axis, this has a MOT, or this has an insulating behavior, and this is what has been plotted here. This is the value of the upturn of the resistivity, so this phase looks very consistent with a MOT insulating. Why I'm keeping saying MOT insulating? Because you saw that the band is either half field or quarter field, so if it were a one electron description, this should be a good metal. So this insulating behavior can only be due to electron interactions, and this is consistent with what we know about a MOT insulator. And now if I lower the temperature at a temperature of about 10, let's say 20 degrees, this has a transition to a spin pyrrole phase. Now if I apply pressure, or if I move further along in the family, I get something which goes from, which has lost its MOT behavior, which is now something which looks like a normal metal, and which at again a temperature of 10 Kelvin has a transition towards an antiferromagnetic state, called here spin density wave if you prefer. And if I apply more pressure, then I get a superconductor. It's a low TC superconductor, it's few Kelvin, 2 point something Kelvin, but it's superconductor nevertheless. I will not talk much more about superconductivity. Let me just mention that nobody has the faintest idea of what the superconducting symmetry in this compound is. It's still a totally open question, whether it's S wave, D wave, P wave, Z wave, or whatever you want it, and people are killing happily each other on this issue. Now, what are the questions that I would like to address? We have here a really fascinating compound because we have stack of chains, so here the chains would be perpendicular to the board, and this is the direction where the hopping integral is the largest. The hopping integral is about 3000 Kelvin, if you want to get an idea of the bandwidth. And then I have two hopping integral, which allows me to leave the chain, so which makes the material two and then three dimensional, which are down by one order of magnitude. So the largest one is 300K, and the smallest one, because the chains are further separated away, is 20K. So now you can immediately see that this compound will undergo a phenomenon that you can see as a dimensional crossover. You can forget about interaction for a moment, and let me describe that in a one electron picture. If I have such hierarchy of hopping integrals, let me forget about the last one for the moment, and I try to plot the Fermi surface of such a compound, Ka is the direction along the chains. In the absence of hopping between chains, I would get totally flat Fermi surface here. Now, if I have a hopping along the chain, then depending on the wave vector perpendicular to the chain, the Fermi surface is warped, and this is the tight binding, if you want, description of electrons with a very anisotropic hopping. Now, if I have such a compound, and I'm at high temperature or high energy, frequency, for example, or temperature, then essentially either thermal or energy that I'm pumping in my system is broadening this Fermi surface, is washing out the warping of the Fermi surface, so the system has no way to know that hopping between the chains exists. In that case, the physics of this system will be described by one-dimensional physics. Now, if I lower the energy, if I lower the temperature, then I will be sensitive to the warping of the Fermi surface, and then my system will know it's not one-dimensional. It will know that it's either 2D, or if I go below this energy scale, it's 3D. And therefore, by simply varying a parameter like the temperature or the external energy of the system, I can take the system from a one-dimensional behavior and bring it to a two- or three-dimensional behavior. So I have in this system the possibility to study the dimensional crossover between one dimension, which, as we will see, is not a Fermi liquid. There are good theoretical reasons to believe that a one-dimensional interacting electron gas is not a Fermi liquid, to something which is more 2D or 3D, where, by default, we think that interactions lead to something which is more of a Fermi liquid character. But it's still, of course, something we have to decide. Now, one first question that one can ask, this is some kind of description that I gave by looking at free electron picture. In this description, it's clear that the scale, the energy scale for this dimensional crossover, is simply given by the warping of the Fermi surface. So it's directly given by the hopping integral here. When the temperature is of the order of this hopping integral, the system crosses over from 1D to something different. And the first question we want to ask is how this crossover scale is modified by the presence of interaction. So this makes a lot of questions that I would like to try to address here, and we will try to do it by order of increasing complexity here. The first question I told you without insisting too much, and nobody yelled so far, so either you're digesting the nice meal we had or you agree with me, is the fact that the high temperature phase will be something which is described by a one-dimensional system in which the interactions are supposed to be important. And in that case, I will recall you what I mean by that, but in that case, we know that a one-dimensional electron gas is something which is called a Luttinger liquid. And because I told you that the system has commensurate filling, the band is quarter filled or can be viewed as half filled because of this dimerization, one has a Mott insulator. So we are first to assert whether we are happy with this, and it's not an easy thing to decide on, because as I showed you, if you look at the resistivity, if you look at the transport property, it looks pretty much Fermi liquid-like. So this is first one thing we have to decide, whether the high temperature phase, the high energy part of this material can be described by a Luttinger liquid. Now, the second question is, what is the strength of the interaction? One can do, of course, first principle calculation, try to extract the interaction from first principles. I'm not the right person to really discuss that, but it would be very nice if one could have a way to measure the strength of the interaction. And again, on this, people have been happily killing each other to know really what is the strength of the interaction you have to put on it. It's a very complicated issue because the basic building block of the material is a very complex molecule on which it's not totally easy to estimate what is the U or whatever V you want to put in a Hubbard type description for this material. Now, if we know how to answer these questions, the second step we would like to have is to describe this dimensional crossover, in particular, what is the scale, and then, of course, what is the phase in which you go into when you lower the temperature. Even if it's a Fermi liquid, what is the description of this Fermi liquid? What does it look like? Okay, so are there any questions at that point, or? Okay, good, so I continue. And I would like to first address the question of the high temperature phase. So before I do that, I need to put some theoretical background and remind you briefly, for those who are not familiar with it, what is a one-dimensional interacting electron gas supposed to give you. And this is something which has been studied since the 60s, and this is something which is known now as a Luttinger liquid. And I'll just give you a cartoon of what a Luttinger liquid is. Now, if you take one-dimensional interacting systems, electrons, and you look at what are their property, you find that they are totally different from standard Fermi liquid. The Fermi liquid is something in which you have excitations in the system that looks like free electrons. So if you try to add an electron in the system, it will dress by changing, pushing a little bit the other electrons because of the interactions, but all in all, it will propagate in the system like a free electron. Its mass will change, it will become some effective mass, other properties will change, but in effect, it will look like a free electron. Now, let's look what happens if you try to do such an excitation in the 1D electron gas, and here I've represented, quote, the ground state of a one-dimensional chain by putting, let's say, spin up, spin down, spin up, spin down, and so on and so forth. It's not an ordered state, but it will be good enough for our purposes here. And now I try to make an excitation by removing one electron, so something which has both a charge that I've removed here and a spin, which was a spin down. So this would be my single electron excitation, something that, for example, I could probe in photoemission experiment. And now I look at how this guy would propagate in the chain, and it will just move here by pushing all the other spins. And you see that after a while, you now have a place where you get the hole here, but around the hole, the antiferromagnetic arrangement here is perfect. Up, down, up, down, up, down. So this is a place where you get a charge missing, but you have no spin missing. And this is an excitation that only carries charge and no spin, and people have called this a holon. And you have a place here where you get two spin up close by to each other, and therefore you have a spin missing, and this is an excitation which carries a spin but no charge. So this little cartoon shows you immediately that in a one-dimensional electron gas, you get no single particle, no quasi-particle in the Landau sense, and all excitations will be separated into a charge sector, something which carries charge and no spin, and a spin sector, something that carries spin and no charge, which are called respectively spin-on and holon. The consequence of that is that if you look at any correlation function in one dimension, this correlation function will decay with non-universal power law, which depends on the interaction. So for example, if I plot the spin-spin correlation function, in a Fermi liquid, this would decay as 1 over x squared. And in one dimension, you can check that the 2kF part of this correlation function has a non-universal decay with an exponent which depends on a certain parameter that I call k rho, which contains the interactions. So, in fact, you can show that all interaction effect can be sort of hidden into what is the one-dimensional equivalent of the Landau parameter in a Fermi liquid, which here are called the Luttinger parameters, and which tells you what is the decay of the interactions in a one-dimensional system. So this is, again, something which is drastically different from a Fermi liquid, because, again, in a Fermi liquid, you would have had universal decay of the correlation function with universal exponents independent of the strength of the interaction. So can we probe that? And can we check whether or not one has something like this, or whether one has something which is a Fermi liquid. The first indication that something strange is going on at high temperature is given by this temperature dependence of the conductivity. You see that you do not have the T square law, but you have something which is more linear in T, and you have to look at that with the eyes of faith if you want to see something which is linear, but it's certainly some indication that at least it's not a simple Fermi liquid. I think the most clear and neat proof that the high temperature or high energy part of these compounds is not a Fermi liquid, despite the fact that you get here something which looks like nice metallic behavior, is given by the optical data that was measured, I would say, roughly 4 years ago. You see that, and let me focus on the solid curve here, and beware that this is a scale which is a logarithmic scale. I hate this logarithmic scale, but for some reason spectroscopists like it, so okay. This is the Joule peak. And what you see, and this is the low temperature. These are data which are taken at various temperature, and the more you have a dip here, the lower the temperature in the system is. You clearly see that this system has a Joule peak, which is very narrow, and then you have a gap up to 100 wave numbers, and then you have something which is a gigantic bump here. And if you look at the spectral weight, 1% of the spectral weight is in the Joule peak, and 99% of the spectral weight is in this bump. So this looks like something which is a slightly doped Mott insulator. You have a very small number of carriers, quote, in this Joule peak, and then you could say I have a Mott gap here, and most of the weight is excitations above the Mott gap and across the above the Mott insulators. So this optical data very clearly shows that these systems behave as slightly doped Mott insulator. Now, when I say slightly doped, sorry?
Are both experiments from the same system?
To tell the truth, I don't remember on which this one was taken. It's TMTSF. I don't remember whether the anion is the same then for this particular curve. But both are on TMTSF systems.
I think the left one is
PF6. Is this is PF6? Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Numbers don't agree. I mean, optical conductivity.
No, no. You can check. Okay, that's why I'm saying I don't remember what is the anion for this one. But if you do the optical conductivity and you check with the DC transport, you can clearly check that the value you get at zero frequency matches perfectly the one that you measure if you do it on the same system and on the same sample. It works. The sum rule is obeyed. I mean, you get all the spectral weight you want here, and as I said, you get 1% of the spectral weight here and 99% here.
No, no, but there's a giant change in the spectral weight in this.
Yeah, but you get spectral weight in the middle, so that works.
So,
yeah, it works.
Because it's law.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, it works. As far as I know, the sum rule is respected. Yeah.
No,
there is no problem of the sum rule. Yeah.
The spectroscopy is, of course, they will match the low frequency end to the DC, so of course it's
going to be. Okay.
But keep in mind here what can happen is that I don't know which direction.
This is along the chains. This is along the chains. Yeah, both of them. To answer your questions, okay, again, I'm not the one who did the experiment, but when I chatted with Leo De Giorgi, he told me that he can match the optical data with the DC data. So I don't think it's something which is put in the Kramers-Kronig from the start. What they claim is that it matches. Okay. You should ask him. Okay, so now the good thing is that you can compare this data with what you expect in a Mott insulator in one dimension, or what you expect from a Luttinger liquid in one dimension. How much time do I have?
Good question.
Okay.
I think you have 15, 20 minutes.
Okay, good. So let me speed up a little bit. What you find if you do the transport in a Lettinger liquid or in a Mott insulator, you find that because of this non-universal power law that I mentioned for the correlation function, the optical conductivity should have a gap up to the Mott gap and then behave as a power law with an exponent which is depending on this parameter k rho, which is depending on the interaction. And furthermore, it contains another parameter, which is the order of commensurability. So it tells you whether you have a quarter field system, whether you have a half field system, and what is the nature of the Mott insulator you have in this system. So from the optical data, you can in principle first check whether you can fit this to a power law and extract this parameter k rho, which will give you the strength of the interaction. And second, decide on the order of commensurability in this system. So this is something that one can do. You can do some additional thing concerning the dimensional crossover that I skip for the moment. So if I take the optical data, you can rescale the optical data by the value of the gap. And these are data taken on three compounds with different counter ions, and you see that they behave in the same way. And if you try to fit that to a power law, you get a pretty decent fit, which, but I am biased, in my mind is very well consistent with the Lettinger liquid description, and which I think is a very strong proof of the Lettinger liquid behavior in these materials. And furthermore, from the fit, you can extract the value of k rho, and you find a value of k rho which is 0.24 or so, which will not tell you much if you're not familiar with Lettinger liquid, but which tells you that you have extremely strong interactions in the system. So from the optical data, you can at least answer the first part of the question that I was asking. The high energy part of this, the high temperature behavior of this system is indeed very well consistent with a Mott insulator or Lettinger liquid. And these systems are described by a quarter field system with k rho equals 0.23, which means relatively strong repulsion. As a bonus, you can show that the dimerization is not important, which was not obvious from the start, and this should be considered as quarter field Mott insulators. Now, this has been confirmed in a novel compound that was synthesized by Patrick Bataille and whose Denis Jérôme mentioned in his talk, so I will not deal much more with this compound, but this is a compound in which the stack is not dimerized and which is still behaving as a Mott insulator. So I think we have here a very good example in these Bechgaard salts of a Mott insulator that can be realized with a quarter field compound and not the standard Mott insulator that you get at half filling. Okay, let me skip the rest. Now, if you look at the optical data, and there are other ways also to consider that, you find that you get deviations from the one-dimensional behavior at an energy which is of the order of 100 k. So now the next question we want to do is what is the scale of the dimensional crossover and whether we can understand this energy scale. Before I move to that, let me point out that there is another property that one might want to check concerning this Lettinger liquid behavior, which is this issue of spin and charge separation. Whether one can explicitly check that one has spin degrees of freedom on one hand, charge degrees of freedom on one hand, and they are separated. There is indication when you look at the spin susceptibility versus the charge properties, which is the transport here, because in some sense you see that in all this material the spin susceptibility is relatively insensitive to the nature of the material, whereas the charge transport changes a lot, as we mentioned already. So this is an indication, and I don't want to push it more than that, this is an indication that the charge degrees of freedom are decoupled from the spin degrees of freedom. This is also supported by recent data on thermal transport, where people compared the thermal conductivity from the standard electric conductivity and found that the Wiedemann-Franz law was violently violated in these compounds. I don't think this is the smoking gun experiment to show spin-charge separation, but it's certainly strongly suggestive that in these compounds, somehow the charge degrees of freedom are living their life and the spin degrees of freedom are living their life. And here you can say that the Wiedemann-Franz law is violently violated because the heat is transported by the spins, and even if you localize the charge, it doesn't really matter. So For the moment, this is indications. It would be lovely to have proof by photoemission, for example, but as far as I know, for the moment, this has not been reached. So, okay, so let me move now to this question of dimensional crossover. So we have here on a temperature versus interchain hopping axis, a little bit the various possible phases that one could get. If you're at very low temperature, but you're strictly one-dimensional, you get the Mott insulator. If you move to temperature larger than the Mott gap, then you have a behavior which is very close to the one of a Luttinger liquid. And if now you put an interchain hopping, which is too strong, you will cross over to something which I call Fermi liquid in need of a better description, but which is not 1D. I should have put not 1D here instead of Fermi liquid because we don't know what it is. And how to study this dimensional crossover? This is a very difficult question, and this has been tackled by a variety of techniques since, I would say, the 70s or even probably earlier, the 60s. You can find a sort of digest of this issue in a recent CONMAT paper that we put on the web. Now, there are various ways to tackle this. The first one is, of course, to start from the one-dimensional system and do renormalization group or do renormalization study, so perturbative study in the perpendicular hopping. And what you find is that the perpendicular hopping is a relevant variable, and therefore it will drive the system away from the 1D behavior. But although it's relevant, it's strongly affected by the interactions, and because all correlation functions in one dimension are power law of, let's say, temperature, whatever, with an exponent which depends on the interaction, you find that the energy scale at which this dimensional crossover takes place is also affected from the bare one, which would be the perpendicular hopping, as I mentioned before, by an exponent which is again dependent on this k rho parameter, so which depends on the interaction. The basic idea is that if you have interaction along the chain and one electron tries to jump to go to the neighboring chain, it will be kept on the chain by the interaction, so it doesn't like to jump anymore. And the stronger the interaction, the more difficult it is for the electron to jump to the other chain. So the stronger the interaction, the more this parameter k rho will deviate from 1. You can see that if you put 1 in this formula, you will find that the crossover scale is indeed T perp. And the more the interaction, the lower this energy scale will be. But still, for normal interactions, you find that the hopping is still relevant and will drive the system away from one dimension. Now, if you have a Mott insulator, it's even worse, because now, to get some picture here, you have your electrons that have been localized, that do not like to hop to not pay the repulsion, but it's the same thing if they try to hop on the neighboring chain. If they hop on the neighboring chain, they will pay some repulsion, so the Mott insulator behavior really wants to kill the interchain hopping. If you have one chain, you have a Mott insulator as soon as you have repulsive interaction for half filling, for example. But if you are in a 3D material or 2D material, what is the common vision is that you need to get, you have a Mott insulator only if you exceed some threshold of interaction. So in some sense, a one-dimensional system likes to be Mott insulator, so it doesn't like to have the electrons hopping around to destroy the Mott insulator. On the other hand, the three-dimensional system doesn't like to be Mott insulator, so it likes to have the electrons hopping around. So there will be a fierce competition between the interchain hopping and the Mott gap to try to kill the interchain hopping. And this competition is seen experimentally. If you plot, depending on the compound here, the Mott gap that you measure either from optics or from photoemission, and you compare it with the interchain hopping. So this is the interchain hopping of the material, and this is between interchain hopping and twice interchain hopping. You find indeed that you get a crossover between an insulator behavior to a metallic behavior here. So these compounds are metallic. Roughly, when the interchain hopping is equal to the Mott gap, which is a signature of this deconfinement transition, where the system is pushed by the interchain hopping to become 2D at low temperature, and which is kept to be one-dimensional by the Mott insulating behavior in these compounds, which have a too large Mott gap. So how can... Yeah?
Which of these systems are now metal? I couldn't follow that.
Oh, sorry. This one are insulators. even at low temperature, and this one become metal. So this one have a large mod gap, okay, and this one have a small mod gap. The mod gap is measured, let's say, from the optics. So even if you have a small Drude peak, you have a very well-defined mod gap in the optic. And now you can see that the crossover between the metallic to the insulating regime occurs when this mod gap, which is measured from the optics, crosses roughly the interchain hopping, which is computed from, let's say, first principle calculation. Okay, that's why this one has a relatively wide range. So as a rule of thumb, the compounds go from 1D at low temperature, so they are confined, they stay 1D even at low temperature, although there is, in principle, some interchain hopping, to a 2D or 3D regime at low temperature, when the mod gap is small enough and cannot confine the electrons in the chains. Okay.
What are the stars here?
There are... that's a good question. This is probably what they got directly from the dielectric constant. This one is extracted from the conductivity. This one is extracted from the fit to the DC conductivity, and this one is extracted from the dielectric constant directly. Well, to some extent, if you want, this one and this one are very similar, because this one is also got by Kramers-Kronig on the reflectivity on the system. Okay. Now, one method to tackle it, as I mentioned, one can sort of use renormalization group argument, but the problem with renormalization group argument is that they just tell you that the interchain hopping is relevant. And it tells you that it transformed the 1D system into something else. And then you have to stop. So what we would like to have is a method which allows us to go through the crossover and to be able to describe both the 1D limit and to describe the 3D limit or the coupled chain limit. And of course, this is very difficult to do from an exact method. So what we did was to try to use, again, a mean field theory method. But one, so this dynamical mean field theory method, but one cannot use it in the standard way, because if one takes a single site, as it was done to describe, for example, 3D materials, standard 3D materials, then one would lose the Lettinger liquid physics, because you still want to be able to describe an isolated chain. So what is necessary to do is to do, if you want, D equal infinity plus 1, so treat chains in which the electrons can hop from one chain to the other, and you couple this chain to an infinite number of other chains, or if you want, you take the perpendicular dimension to be very large, but you still retain the chain direction. So if you want, you can view this as an effective one-dimensional problem, where you say my electrons hop from the chain into a bath, they do whatever they want in the bath, and at some later time, they go back into the chain. Clearly, this is something that will contain the one-dimensional limit. If you make T perp equal zero, you have to solve a one-chain problem. So this is something you have. And this is clearly something that will also contain at least a Fermi liquid description of the three-dimensional limit. So I don't want to enter into the equation, just to show you that this is the standard equations that one will have to solve, where you have your effective one-dimensional problem, where electrons can disappear at one point and one time on the chain, do whatever they want, and then reappear at a later time, at a later point on the chain. This is both the standard kinetic energy and the passage into the bath, if you want. And then they interact in the one-dimensional chain by your standard interaction. And you have to do the self-consistent equation to solve this thing. Now you can extract a lot of physical quantities, and I've just shown here the perpendicular conductivity of the system. So the conductivity. No. This is a mean field solution.
Sigma.
Which sigma? This one?
Yeah.
No, in this thing, all vertex correction nicely vanish.
For the perpendicular
conductivity. Yeah. Sorry, there was another question?
Yeah, it was also about vertex correction, because in the chain, you wouldn't have...
No, again, for the perpendicular conductivity, the vertex correction vanish within this approximation scheme. For the in-chain conductivity, vertex correction are there, And so far, I don't know how to solve, how to compute that in a simple way for the coupled chain. Of course, for a single chain, this is the calculation that I showed you before, and one can compute everything one wants using this bosonization technique. Okay. Okay. So let me. Maybe I should skip that. The main point I want to make on this slide, let me forget that because this is becoming relatively technical, but the main point I want to make is that one can write the equations, but they are pretty difficult to solve analytically. So that's the drawback of the method. Analytically, one can do some simple calculation, and this is what we did, for example, with Antoine Georges and Nancy Sandler, and compute, for example, the scaling behavior of the transverse conductivity. Sorry, this is the conductivity perpendicular to the chain, not the in-chain conductivity. It's a perpendicular conductivity. And one finds, again, some power law of the frequency and temperature at high temperature or high frequency with an exponent which is fixed by, this k rho parameter. And if one takes the k rho parameter, one extracts from the optical conductivity, one has a well-defined value for this exponent alpha. And this is not inconsistent with the experiment. One can extract another quantity, which is, you mentioned some rule in a moment. You can extract what would be the weight in the Drude peak for the perpendicular conductivity compared to the total weight. And you find that this varies as some given power of the T perp, and one can compute this power. And again, if I compare with what is the optical conductivity, which has been measured in the three directions, so this is the conductivity along the chains, this is the conductivity perpendicular to the chain at various temperatures, and you see that if you're at high temperature, there is no Drude peak, and then when you pass, let's say about 100K, no Drude peak, and below 100K, you see a clear Drude peak perpendicular to the chain, which is an indication that there is no coherent hopping between the chain and that the material has become two-dimensional. The conductivity in the weak conducting axis is pretty difficult to extract as connection with whether one can match or not match with the DC. Clearly for this part of the conductivity, it's not matching with the DC, so this is something which would need to be refined. But you see clearly that the conductivity is increasing function of the frequency, which is not inconsistent with the power law that was put forward here with an exponent 0.6. So at least this is something which is not completely crazy. Now, if one wants to go further and extract more from the equations, one has to solve them numerically. And for the organics, one would like to solve the problem which corresponds to a quarter field insulator. And if you want to model that, it corresponds to an extended Hubbard model. And for the moment, it's too complicated. So what we did with Zilke Biermann, Antoine Jord, and Sascha Lichtenstein was to sort of show that in principle, the method would work by looking simply at a Hubbard model. So it's not directly applicable to the organics because it will deal with a half-field Mott insulator, but it's a way to check whether this method can indeed describe the dimensional crossover. So I skip the technical details. Here is what you get if you're not exactly at half-filling, if you're not in the Mott insulating phase. Now here you expect, as you lower the temperature, to go from the Luttinger liquid at high energy and then crossover at some energy scale to something which is a Fermi liquid. And if you measure this parameter k rho that I was mentioning, you find that indeed this parameter is going from some value, which you can check is the correct value for the Hubbard model at high energy. So this is exactly what you can get from Betteransatz in the Hubbard model. And then at some energy scale, which one identifies as this dimensional crossover scale, it jumps to k rho equal 1, which is a way for this method to tell you that you have a Fermi liquid. K rho equal 1 is, quote, non-interacting electrons, which mean universal power law in the correlation function, so you get back a Fermi liquid. If one extracts the energy scale that one gets from the numerics and compare it with this renormalization group formula that I mentioned before, sorry about that, theta is the alpha that was on the previous slide, one gets pretty good agreement, which shows that this formula is indeed quantitatively correct. If one is at commensurate filling, so half filling for this case, one can do the same thing and say, let me look at what happens when I increase the T-perp. I would go from the Mott insulator behavior, and at some point my electrons would deconfine, jump into the other chain, and now I should get a Fermi liquid behavior. And you can see that in the numerics, K rho in the Mott insulator is zero. It's the way, again, you can model the Mott insulator in this thing. You see that this is zero, zero, and suddenly jumps to one, which is again the signature of the Fermi liquid, and the crossover occurs at this value. And again, if you compare with this rule of thumb that I was mentioning before, which was that the crossover occurs when the perpendicular hopping is of the order of the Mott gap, you find pretty good agreement with the numerics. One can extract quantities which are more interesting, and in particular, what would be the Fermi liquid that one would end up at low temperature? And this is an interesting question because there are other approximate methods to deal with this dimensional crossover that were cruder approximation and that had a striking prediction. This was an RPA approximation, and that had the striking prediction that if you started from a one-dimensional interacting system, you would end up with pockets on the Fermi surface at that position. And therefore, you can check doing this numerics whether one agrees with this prediction of pockets or not. And as far as our numerical calculation shows it, for these values of the interaction and for the Hubbard model, what we find at low temperature is that the Fermi liquid we get in 2 is a relatively nice Fermi liquid with a relatively nice Fermi surface here. Here are the numerics. Numerical points corresponding to the Fermi surface. So there is no sign of pockets. And the shape of the Fermi surface you get is very close to the one you would get naively by putting the tight binding hopping and doing a single particle description. One can also compute the quasi-particle residue, and you see that it's pretty much constant along the Fermi surface. So again, for the values of U that we have considered, there is no real sign of hot spots or special points on the Fermi surface. Okay. One can compute the transverse conductivity also, and I'll skip that. And as I said, this is more a demonstration of principle that the method works. So let me conclude by a few puzzles that these compounds show, because it's not finished. I told you that below 100K, the compounds was becoming three or two-dimensional. But if you look at the NMR in these compounds, the NMR is highly anomalous. It deviates from the Coringa law and is definitely not a Fermi liquid. So the question we have now is that we know from the optical data that the system is not a one-dimensional system below 100K, which is a, I would say, progress before what was known in the 70s or the 80s, because people were thinking that the crossover scale was at about 10 Kelvin or 20 Kelvin. Now we know it's much higher. But then this leaves us with the problem of what is the phase here, which is between this 100 Kelvin, where the system stops to be one-dimensional, becomes two-dimensional, and shows this anomalous NMR, whether it's a long crossover which does that, or whether one has an example of two-dimensional non-Fermi liquid system. Okay. The Hall effect is very weird, but I don't want to enter into that. So I will conclude on that. I think, again, I tried to make a survey of the properties of these Bechgard salts. These are really fascinating materials with a lot of various interesting properties. I think we now have a proof from transport that the high energy phase of this material is indeed a Luttinger liquid. This is the first time one can really nail down these Luttinger liquid properties in these systems. The parameter K rho is pretty strong, pretty low, which means strong interaction. These systems are quarter field Mott insulator. And what is the novelty is that one can show also that the crossover scale between the 1D behavior and the, let's say, 2D behavior occurs at a much higher value than anticipated, which is around 100K. We have, in principle, a method in this dynamical mean field theory to tackle the dimensional crossover. And of course, what one would like to do now is to really tackle the quarter field system to address the question of the organics. And among the, I think, the two main questions that one would like to answer is, what is the nature of this 2D phase? Because it seems to be a non-Fermi liquid. And the second one is, of course, what is the nature of the ordered phase, like the superconducting one? And on that, I think I will conclude.
Okay, so I think what we'll do is take just a few questions and try to leave time for a global discussion after the three talks.
Let me understand the bullet one of your conclusions on,
yes,
on the previous page. So it's a lot in general.
Yep.
So transport, you mean optics?
Optics.
So it's spectroscopy.
Yes.
Now, and okay, this conclusion follows that the power law you fit to. Okay, now this tail is not, the fit is not to the Drude, the fit is to
the... No, the Drude is not in 1D regime, because
right.
The Drude is low temperature, low frequency, and in this regime,
so
the hopping between the chain is crucial.
So it's the band and it's the decay of the band.
So it's above the Mott gap, yeah.
Okay, so is there any other explanation for the probably are different reasons to get a power law, so if you remain entirely open mind, because this is an extremely strong statement,
yeah,
and we should be cautious too.
Okay, what I can tell you is that one, the other explanation one can think of is, say, that for some reason you would like to get some semiconducting behavior or something like this. If you do that and you compute what should be the power law for a semiconductor, you find that it should be omega to the minus 3. And what is measured is omega to the minus 1, essentially. And I don't know any simple way of getting omega to the minus 1 other than by saying you have this non-universal power law coming from Luttinger liquid.
1 over omega or 1 over omega minus omega naught?
No, it's essentially 1 over... Oh, sorry, I will need to back up a lot, but... this behavior here is essentially 1 over omega.
So it doesn't know about this 1 there. So it doesn't know that there's a peak at 1.
Well, again, the power law will be roughly valid up to twice the gap or 3 times the gap. Then you get the behavior close to the gap, which is influenced by the gap itself, even in a purely 1D theory. So if you want to say it's a power law and you could push the bandwidth to infinity, this is roughly the bandwidth of the system. But if you could push this bandwidth to infinity, this would decay as 1 over omega. And again, I'm not aware of any other reasonable explanation that could give such a power law besides Luttinger liquid.
Stuart?
You probably said it, but I didn't quite catch it. One of the interesting aspects of the compounds you touched on, and that is the small oscillator strength at very low frequency.
Mm-hmm.
In your view, how does this oscillator strength vary with the T perp, and what physical picture we can associate with that?
Okay, there are various ways you can sort of understand that, depending on your degree of rigor. The crudest qualitative thing you could say is, I've got 1D chains, and I got this Mott insulator, so I shouldn't get any Drude peak at low frequency. Now the electrons hop in and out, so it's like if they doped the chain a little bit, so now I get a Drude peak at low frequency. Of course, this is too crude, because this would be a purely 1D picture, and one has to take into account the fact that the system, because of the T-perp, does not remain 1D. Now, if you want the answer, just a second, to your precise question, this is the answer. This is the way the oscillator strength in the Drude peak compared to the total strength vary as a function of T-perp.
That's not for the A direction.
Sorry? No, that's not for the A direction. This is in the perpendicular direction. So this is the oscillator strength of the Drude peak on the B direction as a function of the T-perp. No, there is a critical T-perp. This is for a Luttinger liquid. So there is no Mott gap here. But to answer your question for the in-chain T-perp, this is something one has not computed yet, because one is not really able to compute the in-chain conductivity from this mean field theory.
No. Matthew.
How strongly was the Lorentz ratio
The Vindaman? Well, this is data taken as a function of temperature here for, let's say, TMTSF CLO4, which would have a mod gap, an optical mod gap of 200 wave numbers, so 100 Kelvin. And of course, and this is essentially the coefficient that you would get from the charge conductivity, and this is the thermal transport you get. So this would be the thermal transport you would get from the charge conductivity using the Vindaman-Franz law, and this is the one you get, this is the one which is measured. So there is a factor of, I don't know, maybe 10 between the two or so. Well, again, first, I'm not talking about that, but the second, the way these people want to interpret it is to say the heat transport is carried through the spin excitations, whereas the charge transport is essentially blocked by the mod gap. So this is why you get a very small coefficient here, because this is the charge transport, whereas this guy doesn't care about the charge, he's essentially caring about the spins. Yeah, no, if you want my personal point of view, I think this particular experiment about thermal transport would need to be thought much more carefully than the way it was done at the time of the publication of the result, to really decide whether it can sort out and decide on spin charge separation. For me, it's not much stronger than this argument that was said long time ago by, for example, Denis Jérôme, that if you look at the conductivity, it varies a lot between the compounds, whereas the spin susceptibility is not varying much. I think this is something that needs to be sorted out.
Okay, I think that will do for questions. Clearly, one of the outstanding questions that emerges from this discussion is whether there is at all any range of Luttinger liquid behavior. And that's walking the fine line between the Mott scale and the bandwidth of the problem. We'll probably come back to that later. So the two talks that follow have been geared at providing a rather different view of these systems. And the first one is by Stuart Brown, whom I suppose will emphasize antiferromagnetic fluctuations, among other things.